It's time for the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour from PopDose.com and Addicted to Vinyl. Now, here are your hosts, Matt Wardlaw and Jeff Giles.
Welcome to the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. I am Matt Wardlaw, and with me as always is my very good friend Jeff Giles, owner and chief proprietor of PopDose.com. It's been a little while since we've done one of these. The last one we did was with Matthew Ryan back in October, and since that time, I think that both Jeff and I have been busy with all the other things that go on in our daily world, and there certainly have been things that we wanted to do a podcast about, but we just never got it together until now. Now is in right now, the moment that Steve Pultz is releasing his latest solo album, 1999, which comes out on June 19th. If you're a Steve Pultz fan, you've probably been following along as he's been releasing records from his beginnings with the Rugburns to his newest release. It's been an interesting and diverse trip, and it's a good thing if you're a Steve Pultz fan because the guy is prolific. He releases a lot of new music, either on a proper album or via his website at Pultz.com, or it might be something that you hear for the first time live and in the flesh at a Steve Pultz live show. And there's plenty of opportunities for that last one because Steve Pultz is a guy who is on the road relentlessly, seemingly for nearly every day of each calendar year. But if you have absolutely no idea who Steve Pultz is, that's okay too, because there's plenty of time to catch up, and chances are good that you've already heard at least one of his songs. At minimum, he's that guy who you might know because he co-wrote You Were Meant For Me by Jewel. But there's so much more to Steve than that. The press release for Steve's new album, 1999, says the new album is a reminder that the intersection of beauty and madness is a majestic place to spend a little time. It's always a good time to spend some time with Steve Pultz, and we're thrilled to welcome him today for some conversation and also a few live performances. Enjoy this, and don't forget to pick up the new album, 1999, when it comes out on Tuesday, June 19th, and also make sure you check out Steve's website at Pultz.com, where you can find out the latest news and perhaps discover some music that you might have missed along the way. So let's begin, and let's welcome in Mr. Steve Pultz. Well, getting into this, I love the press release for this new record. Your publicist, she made you sound good, and we'll talk about this right off the bat. Certainly, you are good. We love Steve Pultz, but the lines like, Southern California's Steve Pultz is one of the most beloved songwriters of his generation. Dude, I think she just made you into Bob Dylan.
I didn't even read it. I'm blushing now. That's awesome. I should read that kind of stuff, man.
That's how rock and roll you are. You don't even read your own press releases.
I should. I'm really bad at paying attention to that sort of thing.
I started out as a Rugburns fan, and when you first released your first solo album, I think that it was a real left turn that caught me pleasantly off guard. I think it might have blindsided some other folks and perhaps your record label at the time. Yet you're still here. How did you make the transition from band guy to solo guy and make that stick?
Well, it did. It caught exactly what you said. Like, a lot of fans were mad. It was my first experience with fan blowback and getting some negative responses from people because a lot of them were just pissed off. Like, it totally caught me off guard because I was used to people really liking what I did and liking what happened with the Rugburns, or if they didn't like it, I didn't know, or I'd choose not to listen, even though all the time people would come up and go, like, they'd either say, it'd be a guy's wife going, I love you, but my husband hates you, or the husband come up going, I love you, but my wife hates you, your music and the Rugburns. And then when I did the solo record, I remember a lot of Rugburns fans were just pissed because it was a lot mellower and they wanted something different. So but what it was I remember I was playing in Indianapolis one night, and I had written some other type songs for acoustic guitar, and I remember all anybody wanted to hear was Dick's Automotive, and they were just screaming it. People were really drunk, and I just thought, man, I want to do something different next time. I just want to take a left turn. I'm tired of this. So I did that, and now it's all good, so I weathered it.
You know, and it's funny because when I think of Rugburns, Dick's Automotive is one of those songs I think of. And there's just so many songs that you've written through the years. But that's one of them, man, that That's a lot of lyrics to remember, and you've got a lot of songs that are like that.
Yeah, it's funny because I do that song still live, and I love doing it. Like, I never, it's not like I all of a sudden went, I'm never doing those songs again. I just wanted to do something a little different, and then that led to where I'm at now over all the years. But I still love doing it, and I still, when I first went solo, it was funny because I didn't, much of my show was just like, a ton of it was a lot of Rugburn songs. And now I don't do them that often. It's weird how just through evolution and time, I don't do them as much, but I still will do any of them. It's just that it only encompasses a smaller part of the show.
This current tour, is it just you out on the road, or do you have a band on this current tour?
This current one, it's just me with my tour manager, Chris.
I know that you do a lot of touring where it's just, it's just you and the guitar. So I just was curious with kind of the instrumental buildup of this record. I didn't know if you had any additional players out with you to, kind of flesh out the songs, or if it was just, the normal Steve Pultz experience. So I was curious on that.
Yeah, I brought bands out many times, and it's super fun. But I just got back from Australia and just kept going on the roll I was on of playing where I'm at solo.
Yeah, and boy, you've really been, you're one of those guys that you're always out and about. I mean, you mentioned you were in Australia. You were just in Singapore, I think I saw on your website. And I think we have to congratulate you now that you've officially been to all 50 states.
Yeah, I was in Singapore, and I flew right from there to South Dakota to flesh out my 50th state. And I was at Mount Rushmore the day before Memorial Day. I was in Mount Rushmore, and then I flew back on Memorial Day and sang the national anthem at the San Francisco Giants game in San Francisco, sold out 45,000 people. And that was scary. That was really scary. And it's like I do that song and it takes me about a minute and 22 seconds, but it feels like it's only 5 seconds. And I'm always so scared I'm going to screw up the words. And like, seriously, 10 seconds before they came to grab me to sing the national anthem, I was in the little hallway where the players come out of, just kind of like trying to make sure I had my voice warmed up and everything, because it's a hard song to sing. And I couldn't remember. All of a sudden, I forgot what so proudly we... I couldn't remember the word hailed. My mind blanked out. Thank God for my iPhone, because seriously, the girl was waiting for me. She had no clue what I was doing. I was Googling lyrics to Star Spangled Banner, and then I go... Because I was going, what so proudly we came, what so proudly we walked, what did we do so proudly? And then I go, hailed! And I screamed out, hailed out loud, and she looked at me like, what? And I just said, hailed, hailed. And she just looked at me like, okay, he's just a weird musician. And then I got up and did it. But this guy from the Air Force was there because they were doing an Air Force jet flyover. You know how they do at stadiums and stuff?
Yeah.
And so he wanted to time it right for when I said, in the home of the brave. So he says to me, I need you to do a sound check, and I need you to do it 3 times so I can time you each time to see how long it takes. So I did it the first time and it was like a minute and 22 seconds. And I did it the second time, it was a minute and 22 seconds. And the third time, exactly the same. And he goes, I've never seen that before. You did it exactly. He said something like, you're like Rain Man. So I did it, right?
The Rain Man of the national anthem.
Yeah, because my rhythm and tempo was like perfect each time. So that was really weird. So he says to me, now when we get to the home of the brave, you're going to have these jets come flying over really close. It's going to be awesome. But if they're not there yet, I need you to extend it. And I'm like, how the fuck do I extend the national anthem? There's only that many words. So he goes, just like strum it a long time or something. So sure enough, I get for the land of the free. And this is broadcast on television and everything. And the TV girl's going, keep it going, like motioning her hand around and circling the Air Force guys looking at me, keep it going. And the Air Force guy, frankly, between us guys, was scary. Like, you can see why these people have positions of authority. I've never been in the military service, but right away, I had deference towards him. I was scared of him. So he's going, keep it going. So I just started finger picking. I just go, dun, 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 dun. Finger pick that part out. And then I'm still strumming it. And then the jets come flying over my head. It's on YouTube. It's on my website. You can watch the video, actually. And so it was pretty cool to be a part of that.
Do they let you set up a merch table after you do the national anthem?
I did. I said right at the end of it, and the home of the brave. And then I got CDs available over by the hot dogs. Hot dog stand number 22. My new CD, 90.99.
Well, I'm glad we weren't reading about you.
That was cool.
You know, in the headlines for like bringing down Air Force planes into a stadium populated with a sold out crowd. So good job.
I know. Thank you. So it was pretty funny because I was still jet lagged out from Singapore, and then I went straight over to South Dakota, which was really cool. I'm doing a soundtrack for this documentary on this guy who's saved all these wild Mustangs, and he's got a wild Mustang sanctuary. His name's Dayton Hyde. He's written like 20 novels, and he's about 86. And that was really cool. All these horses go running by you and give me a whole tour. Feels like you're in an earthquake.
Yeah, I saw pictures of that.
And now, here I am in Cleveland. Yeah, it was amazing. Really, really cool. So I'm doing a soundtrack for that. And
how'd you get wrapped in with that?
I was on a station one morning called WFUV out of Fordham University in New York.
Right.
And a woman who works for Barbara Koppel, this film director who's done the Dixie Chicks, Shut Up and Sing, and these other movies, heard me on the air talking and kind of being sort of funny and goofy and singing songs. And so her producer came, and then her producer is the one making this film. Her name's Suzanne Mitchell, and she liked my show and then came to see me some other times and then said she wanted me to do the soundtrack to this. So I'm in the middle of that as well as this tour. It's crazy. I've been really busy. Like, I'm not home but more than a month a year. About a month a year is when I'm home.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I was curious about that because it does seem like you're never home. Well, before we continue with some stuff, could we get you to do a song?
A song? Yeah. That's why we're here. What do you, anything? Or something off the new record, right? That's
You know, yeah, I was going to say, I mean, just maybe just as a conversation point, starting with some things about me you should know.
Cool. Yeah, I'll do that. And is this on the radio or can I cuss?
You can cuss.
Oh, you can cuss. Yeah, we're taping it.
Fuck yeah. I like the word belligerent. It rhymes with refrigerant. I'm okay at lying. Scared of dying. I like eating food. I love to be nude. These are some things about me you should know. You should fucking know these things about me. I like to watch others. I love unwed mothers. I'm convinced the world's ending. I like twisting and bending. I have furry ears. I write songs about queers. These are some things about me you should know. You should fucking know these things about me. I'm mean and I'm kind. I'm losing my mind. I don't sleep that much. I use humor as a crutch. I think I'm a fraud. Not sure if I believe in God. These are some things about me you should know. You should know these things about me. I like chocolate cake. I give but I take. I've been to Hong Kong. I sold Jeep a song. I live in hotels. I don't take any pills. quit drinking booze, so it's not any big news. I act really glad, even though I'm real sad sometimes. These are some things about me you should know. You should know these things about me. Ta-da.
Ta-da. Well, I had you play that one because, you know, I think that Jeff probably has some songs in this category. Jeff, you know how sometimes you hear that song that just kind of goes a different place than you're expecting it to go? I mean, one example I would point out is Baby, I Love You by the Yehoos, which the central lyric, you know, sounds sweet enough, and then you get to the chorus and it's, Baby, I love you, just leave me the fuck alone. So for your album, Steve, that definitely was the one that, like, I saw that, man, and I hadn't seen the lyrics, and I'm listening to it, I'm like, oh, this is nice enough, and then all of a sudden, boom, it hits you. So, wow, where did that one come from?
That came from, I think it came about from a songwriting game that I was in, and I don't even know the word we were supposed to say anymore. I think there was some code word we were supposed to say so that everybody knew we did the song that was supposed to be done, and it was due like a couple days later. And I've got to remember what the word was. But I just started writing it. I think I liked, for some reason I grabbed the guitar and just went, I like the word belligerent. It rhymes with refrigerant. And then from there, the song just kind of wrote itself. But I know what you mean about songs like that.
Was this part of like a songwriting circle that you were?
Yeah, I've been in one for years. I started one 9 years ago with Bob Schneider when I was on tour with Bob Schneider and Billy Harvey.
Oh, wow.
And the three of us with a guy named Bruce Hughes, who was playing bass for Bob on that tour. We started this thing. I think Bob Schneider came up with the idea. He said, let's all write a song and call it Cashville, because we were heading into Nashville. So we all wrote a song and used Cashville in it, and then we never quit doing it. And because of that songwriting game with Bob, I've written hundreds of songs that never would have been written because I had deadlines.
Is that, it seems like that would be a pretty useful tool for staying creative on the road.
It taught me a big lesson. I used to think that I had to wait for inspiration. I'd think, God, am I in a cold streak here? Or when's inspiration going to come? I'm going to get that great song. But then I decided that was all bullshit. After doing this game, it was all about laziness and forcing yourself to write and having deadlines. And if I have deadlines, and the reason that this is such a beautiful game is because you don't just have a deadline for yourself. You have to turn it in, and other people and their peers of yours are going to be listening to it. And the key to these songwriting games is to keep the group small. Because we had a time, there were times when our group had like 30 people in it, and you're not going to listen to everybody's song, or I'm not. I just don't have time. But if there's four people in the group, you're going to actually listen to the song because you want to hear how the other person treated the words. And it's kind of fun to hear what they did. But any more than four, and I'm not, I don't have time, nor do I have the attention span. But four people for me is a good amount.
I think stuff like that is really instructive because I know personally as a writer, I'm very much a creature of habit. And anytime I travel or anything that comes along that disrupts my routine, it makes it really hard to write. But for a guy like you, you're a songwriter, but you also have to walk the line of you know, being responsible for managing your career. And that means spending a lot of time on the road. So I imagine you must have to find ways to work around hurdles and creative blocks while you're living your life as a performer.
Yeah, I do. And if that means writing it while I'm on an airplane, you know, like coming up with a melody that I've already started and then working on the words almost as if I was one of those people on a plane doing a Sudoku puzzle, except I'm working on a song and I'm trying to fit it into this rhythmic structure. Yeah. And, it's just, it really is a matter of, I really believe that songwriting is a muscle. And so once you open up those passageways in your brain, you just get used to doing it. I remember I was on tour with Rufus Wainwright, and he called his dad, Loudon, one night after we had played about six shows, and he said, "Dad, I met your illegitimate son," because he used to call me Loudon's illegitimate son because of the way I would play guitar and stuff, and which I thought was a huge compliment because I love Loudon, and I love Rufus too. And yeah, I had so much fun with Rufus, but it was so funny when he said that, "I met your illegitimate son." And he said for his dad, it's like a war. His dad just constantly is writing songs. And I really appreciated hearing that, because I think you really got to stick with it. It's a craft. And I think it's almost like a three-legged monster, where you have to write the songs, and then you have a performance muscle. So you have to learn how to perform them, because you have to get your 10,000 hours in. Otherwise, you're not going to really represent the songs well on stage. You might be too nervous. You have to get over that nervousness and be able to sell the song. And then you have the recording muscle, which is a whole nother leg of the monster, of like learning how to record and actually going in and be relaxed. And you're not going to record anything if you haven't been writing. So I think the best way that we've honed down the songwriting game now, at one point it was we had a song due every day, which is just stupid. Now, if it's due every Thursday, we've come up, like, after many long conversations with Bob Schneider, it was like, we're like, I think every Thursday it's good to have a song due. Every Thursday. It gives you enough time, you know, if you're catching flights or doing something else, to still get a song written. Even if it's a total piece of crap of a song, at least you did it. And by writing that piece of crap song and actually recording it on your iPhone or whatever, you're going to have the song due, and you did it. You completed your goal and your task. And then the next time, you might have a really good song come out of
it. Yeah, I think creatively it's important to do bad stuff. You have to.
Oh, you have to.
You have to get through it to you know, to know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But does a process like this, does it turn it into like a, as a recording artist, does it turn you into sort of a patchwork creature? I mean, does it make it more difficult to establish a narrative thread in your records?
Probably. I have really bad attention span, and I'm really bad at establishing threads. And like, even how you mentioned the bio, like I've always had this really, I've always had a really bad ADD, and I can't concentrate that long. Ever since I was a kid, it was like that. And so yeah, I'm really, it's made me sort of really whimsical and spur of the moment, and I can end up anywhere. And I think that's why I end up playing so many gigs, because I just keep saying yes, and they lead to other gigs. Like, even the thing with Jewel would have never happened unless we hadn't been like dating and going down camping in Mexico and just writing songs for, it's like playtime to me to write songs. And I don't want to have any censorship at all. I want to say anything I want on stage and do anything I want. And that leads to other songs. And it also leads to a lack of focus too. But I don't really care about that. I just care about being in the moment and having fun on stage and letting the moment take me wherever I want to go, because it's all playtime to me before I die. And I'm really aware of, I think of death a lot. Like, I always read the New York Times obituaries, and I'm always thinking, looking at someone's life. That's the one thing that really interests me that I can focus on and read, is people's obituaries. And I'm obsessed with death. Like, I want to put out a coffee table book about maybe what people were thinking the day they died, like interview their friends. And because it's such a mystery, and our lives are so short, and there's such a gift. It's so fun to meet people on the road and talk to them and look them in the eye and meet other musicians and maybe make up a song with them. Shel Silverstein was really good at that, writing songs with other people. Right when he'd meet them, he'd sit right down in a cafe and start writing a song. He was really prolific.
Yeah, you know, I didn't know for the longest time that you were a Shel Silverstein fan, and knowing that, that's something that really definitely sticks out in the lineage of your songwriting.
I love him so much. He was such a great songwriter. Man, Freaker's Ball is one of my favorite songs ever. I just love the lyrics and the imagery, and he was so playful, and all his books. And he started as a cartoonist for Playboy. Pretty wild.
That's crazy. Well, for this new album, you know, working the way that you do, like, what sort of like thoughts did you have down on paper as far as like, do you have like a playbook as far as like, here's where I want this one to go?
No, not at all. I'm really bad at that. I just happened to be in Australia and I was on tour with this guy named Bob Evans, who's in a band that's pretty big in Australia called Jebediah. His real name's Kevin Mitchell, but I met his drummer as I was going into the loo to take a piss after I got off stage, and his drummer was coming out, and he said, "Man, I loved your show," and his drummer's from Perth. So when we got to Perth, he said, "Come check out my recording studio." So I did, and then I just pulled out a guitar and started singing, and he turned on a microphone, and he said, "Let's record a song." So we did, and then he said, "Oh, we should add bass to this." I said, "All right." Next thing I knew, I was making a record. I was flying back to Perth. It's like, it really has no thought at all, except the only time thought ever went in anything was when I got signed to Mercury Records, because they were flying producers in and there was a huge budget. But that kind of stuff bores me. And if it feels right, I just do it. And so I was just at South by Southwest playing a bunch of showcases, and I went in, I was mastering this record that you guys have, and I made a whole nother record that's done, and it's got 16 songs, because the guy mastering it, Lars is his name, he's from Sweden and he's great. He ended up saying, I said to him, "Can I record this song I just wrote?" And he said, "Yeah." He pulled out these great mics, and next thing I know, he said, "Why don't we call some musicians up?" And I ended up making a record and then flying back a week later and finishing it. And then he flew out to San Diego where I did some vocals. And so I have this other record done, and it's going to make Rugburns fans so happy. I'm sitting on a record that rocks really hard. It's got songs like "I Want My Fucking House Back." That's like a Ramon song or something, like really like a wall of sound. Like, you know how they do those licks on "Sheena is a punk rocker." It's a different melody and everything, but the chorus is "I Want My Fucking House Back," and it rocks hard. It's got a bunch of rocking songs on it and a couple soft ones. I'm so excited about that record too. I want to release it as soon as possible because we can do whatever we want today. So yeah, getting back to your question, there isn't a, I'm not good at sitting down and going, on these dates, I'm going to do this song and this is how it's going to be. If you saw how I did things, you'd think that guy's fucking out of his mind. Like, there's no rhyme or reason to a tour or anything.
I wanted to ask you when you knew it was time, like what lets you know it's time to make a record, but listening to you talk, it seems like there really isn't an answer to that.
No, I just like anything to happen. Like if I was with John Doe, I would say to him, and I was in Bakersfield where he lives, I'd say, "John, do you have a studio? We could do this real quick." And then he would lead me there, and then I'd say, "Let's make up a song. Here, add a verse here to this." And even if he said no, I would force him to do it because I'm really good at that.
So how do you let go of a record? How do you know when you're done?
Because another tour starts and I have to hurry and finish it, and the people I'm working with go, "You got to add this to it." And I go, okay. And I fly in, it gets really desperate. It's like late night gramming. And then I listen to it and I think, okay, that's good. Let's get it mastered, you know, after the mixes and stuff. You know what I hate is mixing. I hate mixing. I fucking hate it.
When I was making records, I would have to leave the studio when that was going on because it made me want to stab myself to listen to the same little bit of every song over and over and over again.
Yeah, how do people do that?
I don't know.
Why didn't you stab yourself, Jeff?
Why didn't I stab myself?
Yeah.
You son of a bitch.
Let's all stab ourselves right now. Let's have a triple stabbing and end this conversation with
us turn it into
all
a song.
Killing ourselves.
Hey, Steve, can we get you to can we get you to play Conversation with the Moon?
Yeah. Do you guys watch any series like Mad Men or any of that stuff?
Absolutely.
God, I'm so into it. I don't even know why I asked you that, but I really love it.
I don't know how you have time to watch TV.
Well, I fly a lot. I have long flights. Like, I watched all of Deadwood last month. So when I'm traveling, stuff, oh my God, Deadwood was so good. Have you guys seen that?
Yeah, I did see that.
You cocksucker.
I
cunt, cocksucker, cunt, cocksucker. I love that. How many times they say those words. Mixed in with Shakespeare. All right. Speaking of cunts and cocksuckers, this is called Conversations with the Moon. This song was actually going to be titled Conversations with the World in, with the Moon in parentheses, Cunts and Cocksuckers and Deadwood. But my better judgment stopped me. My back aches, my eyes are shot, my body's running a little bit hot. I miss what I can't see. You're far across the ocean from me, and they're driving on the wrong side of the road to me, and I'm afraid to cross the street. So I got some numbers I can dial to hear your voice and make me smile, but they're just wires without a face. My message floats in the outer space, so I stare up at the stars, past the noise of rows of bars, and I'm a talking to myself. It's just the conversations with the moon. Whoa. There's a bonnet on my car and a torch for when it's dark, but a heart is still a heart. Yours and mine are far apart, so I turn on my TV. They're playing cricket in front of me, and I don't understand thing. And it's still yesterday back home. So I play a show to get some smiles. I travel tens of thousands of miles. Why do I do it every night? Because it just feels fucking right. So I stare up at the stars, past the noise of rows of bars, and I'm talking to myself. It's just the conversations with the moon. Is running a little bit hot.
Cool.
That's awesome.
Thanks.
I love that line about the bonnet and the torch and the heart.
Well, I was in Australia when I made that up, and so they say bonnet for hood of car instead of hood, yeah. And then they say torch, yeah, for flashlight, but a heart is still a heart, I figured, so I threw that in there. So that whole song was written in Australia one night, and there was cricket on TV, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And I wasn't even going to put that song on the record, and then my tour manager, Chris Modell, called me up before we were doing the record. He goes, man, that song Conversations with the Moon, what number is that going in? And I go, what do you mean, what number? He goes, on the new record. I go, oh, it's not even on the record. I'm not putting it on. And then he looked at me like, are you out of your mind? So I said, really? So I put it on.
It's a beautiful song. Well, and that line is poetry, man. I listen to lines like that, and I'm curious how long you spend working on your lyrics.
a minute.
A 100 songwriters just stabbed themselves.
I think we're done here. We just killed off half the songwriting population. So, Steve, thanks for the help.
Hey, Poptos is cool, by the way. I would like to say that for the record. Who started Poptos?
Poptos loves you. I did.
Really? Dude, you're like the guy who started Instagram. Like, it's really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, you're sitting on something
minus $1 billion or so.
Somebody's going to buy Poptos one day for a lot of money. Don't sell it. But
I'll sell it to you.
Sell 49% and just like just oversee it.
That would be nice. I would like that.
Do you watch Game of Thrones?
I'll sell Matt Wardlaw along with it.
Do you guys watch Game of
Jeff.
Thrones?
Thank you.
I haven't seen it.
I have not.
I just started it on the flight. It's really cool. It's crazy. But there's a lot of nudity in it. And I was watching it on my Southwest flight yesterday.
Next to an 8-year-old?
Yeah. And there's like all kinds of sex.
I did that on a flight with Weeds once, and I know the feeling that you're talking about, where you just kind of have to cover up the screen and whatever you're using to watch the show.
It's embarrassing. I know. It really is. I was actually next to a woman who was reading a Bible on a Kindle. That'd be a good We should all write a song called Bible on a Kindle. That's what I loved about it. It was a Bible on a Kindle, and she was very proper looking, and she looked like a church lady, and I was like trying to hide it. I was so embarrassed. And she was reading the passages about Sodom and Gomorrah when this guy's like totally railing this chick from behind, which I thought was pretty cool.
But it was from a historical perspective. Maybe she would have been interested in sharing the show with you.
Maybe.
Should have tapped her on the shoulder. You guys could have started your own songwriting circle.
Oh, man. Because religion has always played a big part in my life. Like, seriously. I've been tortured by religion my whole life. And that's why my...
Not alone.
It affects me in my songwriting and my performance and everything. Like, I always feel guilty.
Yeah, I mean, I think I can definitely see that in some of your stuff. So, I mean, I guess, like, how do you reconcile that? Can you reconcile that?
No, it's like that whole thing, pack your bags, you're going on a guilt trip. Catholic Church laid so much guilt on me ever since I was a kid. It still affects me to this day. It really does. And my mom is 82, and she was just so Catholic, as was my dad growing up. And so I had to live a total double life. I had to get really good at, doing a song and dance routine, like, hello, my baby, hello, my darling, hello, my dad, I'm girl, hello, dad. But now they're totally different. Now they're not even like that, my mom and dad. Now they're, like, totally not Catholic. My mom's, like, into Christopher Hitchens and watches Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert. She's, like, a totally different person. They got over it, but I didn't.
Is that, you think, what drives you to come up with a story like the one in Trash?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, all the forbidden stuff. And it definitely does. But the thing about Trash is it was a combination of two things that made me do it. One was I became friends with a guy who's a guitar maker named Danny Farrington. And he had a book out called Farrington Guitars, Ferrington, and he made guitars for Elvis Costello and Johnny Cash and all these different people. And he got a call from Johnny Cash saying, you know, hey, Danny, it's Johnny. And I got to listen on the other line, and he said, it's Johnny Cash. You know that guitar you made me? I know you only make one of a kind, but I need you to make me another one just like it, because I was on my houseboat in Tennessee and a plane came flying by and dropped off some packages, and it was drugs, and I was a witness to it, and the DEA wants me to testify, and these guys are in the mob, and they came back and burned down my houseboat, and on the houseboat was the guitar you made me.
Jesus.
So Danny was like, yeah, I'll make you another guitar. And then like A year later, he was at the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, and Waylon Jennings came walking to go on stage, and he saw Waylon Jennings carrying the original guitar. So he said to Waylon, "Waylon, where'd you get that guitar?" That's how Danny talks, and Waylon goes, "Johnny gave me it for my birthday." So Danny was like, "Holy shit, he just totally made up this whole story to get a free guitar. Like, what a liar." So then Danny told me about it and said, "I'm going to call him back. And since you were there and listen in on this conversation." So he gets Johnny Cash on the phone. And he goes, "Yeah, Johnny, it's Danny Farrington." And Johnny goes, "Hey, Danny, it's Johnny. Johnny Cash." Just like that. And then he says his full name. And then he goes, "Yeah, I ran into Waylon Jennings at the Ryman Auditorium. He was walking on stage. He had the original guitar." And Johnny Cash didn't even miss a beat. He goes, "Danny, I'm not going to lie to you. Some divers went down. And they were able to get the guitar, and it had been wrapped up in Visqueen plastic and had no water damage. So I didn't have the heart to tell you after they found it. So I just kept it. Gave Waylon the original and kept the new one." So I was like, what a great liar. And then it's actually like a three-part story, because then it brought me back to Leo Kottke, the great guitarist from Minnesota, said, to be a good artist, you have to be a good liar. And he tells a story about his son poking his daughter in the eye, and his daughter screaming and saying, he says, "Why are you screaming?" She said, "Oh, he, like John poked me in the eye." And he said, "Why'd you do that?" And his son said, "I didn't know it was her eye." And Leo Kottke says, "Right then my heart swelled with pride, because I'm an artist in the family." So that combined with a friend of mine named Eric, who lives now in St. Louis, Eric came to one of my songwriting workshops that I teach with this guy in the Mother Hips named Tim Bloom up in Yosemite. And Eric afterwards, he was like the star student of the whole songwriting trip. So we kept in touch. His songs are very literate. He told me, "Let's write a song from the point of view of the guy who gets shot in Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues."
It's a brilliant idea.
And I said, "Oh yeah, good idea." 'Cause it's fun. It's fun to take different songs and then write from the perspective in a song to carry on the song. So his was totally different that he wrote. And for some reason, mine came out to be, "I made Johnny Cash fuck a transvestite and then kill him." Because I figured if Johnny could lie about the guitar, I could make a lie up. And my dad, and the fourth part of the story is, my dad always told me when I was a kid that you could lie in songs. Because I asked my dad, "Why would Johnny Cash shoot a man to watch him die?" And my dad said, "Oh, he's lying. You can lie in songs." And I said, "And it's not a mortal sin? You won't go to hell?" And he said, "No, it's a one time you can lie in songs. One time you can lie in life is if you write a song." Huh. So all those factors were the perfect storm for me writing that song. And so that's how it came about. And so the song is sung from the point of view of the guy that gets shot in Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues, when Johnny says, "I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die." I'm continuing it on from that guy telling why Johnny Cash shot him.
Mm-hmm.
He's a transvestite. Yeah, that song is that's a crazy, dark, dark song.
It's a crowning moment in the record. I wanted to know if you felt like this album had a centerpiece to it.
I'd say that would be the centerpiece.
Okay.
If I was smart enough to pick a centerpiece and plan that far ahead, which I'm not. But if I was, I'm gonna claim it like I did. Yeah, I thought it out. That's the centerpiece of the theme of redemption.
Man, that was really great thinking on your part. It's good you had the sense to think all that out. But so yeah, we'll give you that one. You can claim that one. But
okay, cool.
The other thing is like the opening track of a record, I always find it interesting hearing that, you know, to kind of get a sense of maybe where the record's going to go, which, you know, with your records, I think your records, I don't know if you can necessarily tell that from the opening track, but I thought that Spirit Hands was a pretty powerful opener. What made that the opener for you?
For me, it was...
It has a vibe.
For me, it was I had borrowed a guitar from a friend of mine, and it's a four-string tenor guitar. And I like those four-string tenors, and it was hanging on my friend Gregory Page's wall. He was in the Rugburns with me, Gregory Page. Great songwriter. If you don't know his stuff, it'll blow your mind. So he was the bass player in the Rugburns, and I went over and to visit Gregory, and he had this old four-string tenor sitting on his wall from like the 50s, and I said, "Oh, I love this guitar. How do you tune it?" And he said, "Well, I tune it like a mandolin." And then I went on tour with my friend in Canada, Joel Plaskett, another great artist, who I made my last record Dreamhouse with in Halifax, and he said, I tune it CGCG, but you have to get a 10-gauge string to get the E string to go up to a high C because it'll snap. So I really like the CGCG tuning of a tenor guitar, because a tenor guitar is basically the first four strings of a guitar. Your E, B, G, and D string are what you use. It's only four strings. It's a sweet spot of a guitar. But by tuning it, the D string down to C and leaving the G at a G, and then making the B go down to a G, so it's C, I mean up to a C, wait, C, G, C, G, that's right, and then the E string goes up to a G, it gives it this drony sound. And the first song I wrote on the tenor was Spirit Hands, the opening track, and I came up with that lick that went down, 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 and you can hear the tenor being strummed, that's the sound of the tenor. So that lick was there, and then Bob Schneider wrote me and said, next song is either going to, you can either, he goes, we're going to make this a multiple choice one. You can use all three terms. You can say spirit or spirit school or spirit hands or just one of those words. And I used all of them, spirit hands and spirit school in it, because I like the way it both came out. So then that lick came to me and I was like, lay me down on a field of daisies. Let me dance in a room full of crazies. And then the whole religion thing came on with that, with I was lost, but now I'm found again, and then I was found, but now I'm lost again. And so it was a whole religion thing, and then the hook of the song, the world is cold and cruel, but I'm in the spirit school, full of give and takes, trying to learn from my mistakes. And so I was kind of in a whole thing of, I think I was praying when I wrote that song. Like, I was in a religious phase. I go from believing in some sort of spirit to not at all, to just going, this is all bullshit. So it depends on the day you talk to me, if I believe in a higher power or not. But that day I was like in a redemptive mood. And so that's where that song came from. I thought it was a cool opening track because it had a slam and riff, and it was a good way to start the record.
It is a cool opening.
It definitely does. I mean, it's a massive sounding song, to the point that, like, I almost hear it in a film somewhere. Like, I'd be sitting in an IMAX theater watching one of those IMAX films. I could hear that as the soundtrack. I mean, it's just a big sounding track.
Well, it's weird you should say that, because the soundtrack I'm working on, the woman who's doing it said, let me hear your new record to see if there's anything I want to use on this. And then she heard that track, and we were driving through South Dakota, and she freaked, and she goes, I need just an instrumental bit of this right away. So she got the instrumental bit, and every day I get a text from her going, oh my God, this is perfect for this part of the movie. And I was like, God, I don't even have to write some parts now. That's cool. Makes my life easier. So it's weird that you say that. And but if you ever want to write a song and take a different course of where you're at, if you're stuck, go get a tenor guitar. Look for one on eBay. They're always on eBay. Like, there's old Martins and stuff, or peruse some music stores and find a tenor guitar, but don't tune it mandolin style. Tune it CGCG, and I swear to you, you will write a song right when you pick that thing up. Some song will be written. I tell all people this, and they agree with me.
Advice from a master.
Like, seriously, wow. You will write a song. Because your fingers know how to play the strings, and there's only four strings, and you'll figure out different chord shapes, but you can't really hit a wrong note when everything's C, G, C, G, that you'll just start coming up with these weird, like, Jimmy Page licks. Like, it's got that Jimmy Page type sound.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Jeff, I think I'm going to play guitar. It's going to happen.
Do it. Hell
great,
yeah.
We're going to start our band,
yeah,
finally.
We're finally going to get it together.
Jeff, what city are you in right now? What city's Jeff in?
I'm way out of New Hampshire.
Oh, New Hampshire. Cool.
You going to come visit me on tour?
Live free or die, motherfucker.
That's right.
Hell yeah.
Steve, what sort of stuff are you passing on to, like, the songwriters, like, that you're teaching? What sort of stuff are you trying to pass on to those who are coming up and looking to make their mark now?
That do it for the right reasons, because if you're trying to do it to become famous, you're talking to the wrong guy. I don't know anything about that, but if you're going to do it because you have to do it, then follow it. Otherwise, don't do it. Do it because you have to do it. Find something you're passionate about. And if you have to do it, then by all means, have fun doing it and work at it like crazy, like work, and get your 10,000 hours in, because the world always wants new songs and there's an unlimited supply. But find a place to play your songs so that they have a place to grow up. So I remember I told Jewel years ago, because she was a waitress at a coffee house. I was like, find a club, because I could just tell that she was going to be really prolific and write a lot because she had all these poems. I said, find a place you can play every Thursday night, but make it a place where nobody's playing right now. Let's go out and look for coffee houses. So we did. But the only reason I did that with her at the time was because we were dating. I wouldn't just take somebody and drive them around, but we were like, it was like a total new relationship and we were in love and all that. And I was like, you need to find a place because your poems are really fun and the stuff she was doing was really neat. And I said, but we got to put melodies to it because she didn't know about like choruses and stuff. So it was like, let's listen. Like, she didn't even know who the Beatles were versus the Stones. She was living on a homestead in Homer, Alaska. And, you know, she was skinning her own cattle.
Yeah.
Like cutting cattle open and drying the hide and riding horses, bareback horses. And just this, almost like a feral cat. And so we would listen to music. And I said, find a place where you could play every Thursday. Because if you make it your own, people will start coming. Because, she was handing out flyers on the beach as people were walking by. Hey, my name's Jewel. I'm playing here at this little coffee house. And then people started coming in, other surfers and stuff like that. And she started playing. And then every Thursday she would have like all these new songs and she would dress totally weird, like in lederhosen one day. And the next day, some polyester pantsuit, just thrift store stuff she was picking up. And they were turning out to be these events. And I always tell people to go play at a place where you can make it your own. And then people will keep coming back and have deadlines so that you always have something new to play for the people. And then by all means, have fun doing it. Make it fun, you know? Make it your own.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, Jeff, I want to move towards wrapping up. Do you have anything else?
I think Steve just wrapped it up pretty beautifully with that advice.
Cool. This is a cool podcast you guys have here. Is this a podcast?
It's something that Matt and I do. We do it every so often when an artist that we care about puts out something new.
That's awesome, man. I'm going to send this out to 10,000 people when it's out there.
Excellent. Thank you.
Could we get you to wrap up with one more song? I'd love to hear License Plate Eyes from the last record.
License Plate Eyes from the last record. You got it. Hopefully I can.
Which is, as Jeff would say, that one just kills. That's just such a song. I'd have to think that a lot of songwriters would have killed to write that one.
Really? Cool. I'm glad you like it. I hope I can do it justice. And it's early in the morning here in Cleveland. Well, no, it's not. It's noon. Okay. It's one. Wow. All right. This is called License Plate Eyes. Hopefully I can hit these high notes. Here goes. All right. If it's a dream, it's not what it seems. Depends on your point of view. It's always the same. Floating on a puffy white cloud, with daisies below you, blowing lost in the wind, with laughter curling softly out of your grin. You could be wild, a machine. You could be lost in space or be a green bean in a beautiful field by a beautiful stream. You could be a baseball star on a beautiful team with laughter.
softly out of your grin. Ah, you're almost there. Lost in the wind.
That was super fun. I forgot I made up that song. I'm going to do it tonight now because of that. I haven't done that in a long time.
Awesome.
You know what was fun? We were doing this whole interview. I'm sitting in a Radisson hotel room, and we pulled out my tour manager and sound engineer, Chris Modell, pulled out a ironing board, and he has this really nice microphone sitting on top of the ironing board as a stand. I'll have to send a picture of what this looked like so you can put it. I'm sitting in my underwear with a t-shirt on that says Des Moines, hell yes. And I got the guitar sitting on the couch in the Radisson. So it's pretty awesome scene.
And that's a wrap on the Matt and Jeff Radio Hour. We'd like to give big thanks to our special guest, Steve Pultz. Make sure to pick up his new album, 1999, when it hits stores next Tuesday, June 19th. Pultz.com is the place for all Steve Pultz-related information, and you can keep up with all things Popdose-related and otherwise at Popdose.com. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon.